Hello everyone, this is Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here at Cedar Ridge. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're in a series at the moment called Stories of Comfort and Hope. And today we're going to look at the story of Jacob and Esau. It occurs in the first book of the Bible, Genesis. And it's about two brothers who fall out terribly due to trickery and deception, but are eventually reconciled. And we'll explore this theme of reconciliation as a source of comfort and hope. I want to encourage you to read the story for yourself if you can. It's about 9 chapters long, from Genesis 25 to 33. But you can read it in one sitting, and you'll get so much more out of the story, I think, if you read it yourself. Hopefully you'll get something out of this message in and of itself too. But I'm only going to be able to just address one or two parts of the story in detail. I'll skim over a lot of it. And I'm going to emphasize today really looking at some of the background, some of the context, hopefully provide some helpful insights that will help you as you look at the story yourself. Also want to encourage you to look at the discussion materials that we have available this week. They focus on using different art forms, music, poetry, and paintings as a way of reflecting on the story. And I think art really helps us reflect in a different kind of way on ourselves and on the nature of reality. I think art, like poetry, can kind of put words to feelings that perhaps we didn't even know we had or couldn't really express. Music can do the same kind of thing. And in doing so, I think it's a source of great comfort to us because we know that we're not alone. Somebody can write something hundreds of years ago about a sense of longing, despair, comfort, hope, whatever, and we have that same feeling. And we know that, we're part of humanity. We're not alone in our existence. And that itself can be very comforting. So I encourage you to read the story, look at the materials. The story itself is an art form. It's a beautifully written story. I encourage you to consider this a story rather than a literal history. Most historians would say these probably came from oral traditions. These characters probably existed at some point, but the stories have been told and retold and passed down over generations. The story itself is set in the Middle Bronze Age, around the year 2000 BCE or so, but not written down until the Iron Age, probably 1,000, 1,500 years later. So they're not necessarily accurate history. I'm not sure that they're meant to be, but they're being told for a reason. And so we're going to look at the way they're told, how and why, as well as what we are being told. And I think that we'll get much more deep meaning out of it there. Rather than just a specific history, we'll get a meaning that I think we can apply much more to our own selves universally if we look at it that way. We've got to bear a few things in mind as we read them, though. Firstly, these stories have an agenda. The agenda is a political one in many respects. Israel is writing these stories down to show why they are in the land they're in, who their enemies are and why, and how God has been with them all throughout and is with them now. So there's an agenda there that isn't necessarily our agenda. We can probably be a little bit more objective about it than that. So that's something to bear in mind. Also, these stories are from a very different world to ours. There's something about that that's very obvious, and that's the sort of the blatant patriarchy. I'm not saying patriarchy doesn't still exist, but it's so blatant in these stories. There's polygamy and the use of handmaids and all sorts of treachery and cheating and lying. I don't think we're meant to think that that's right just because it's there in the Bible. That's just part of the historical context. But there's other aspects to this story that I think maybe we are less obvious. Or we're different in a less obvious way. And that's, for instance, the way in which God is described, or the view about how God acts, who God is or what God is. And in these stories, the notion of God is very similar to the ancient Mesopotamian pantheon, the Canaanite pantheon, and later the Greek pantheon, where gods are very mythological. They are almost like human beings with supernatural powers who come and go, intervene sometimes, don't intervene on other times, who who are kind of can be treacherous and fickle, take sides and all that kind of thing. And you know, we need to be careful, I think, that we don't therefore say, oh, that's how God is, because we know the view of God changes over time in the scriptures. Jesus brings a different view about God, and I think as a humanity, our view of God has evolved over time, and that's not a bad thing. So we need to just bear that in mind as we read the stories. And I think we're given permission to do so by the text itself, actually, because there's different ways of looking at God in the story itself. There's a name for God used, Elohim, where God is often transcendent, removed, somewhat austere. And there's another name for God used, Yahweh, and that God seems to be much more imminent, present, more human-like, takes sides, and is sort of moving the story along. And so, you know, there are different views of God even in this story. And so it's okay, I think, to look at the story in that sense somewhat critically. And we'll come on to that a little bit more at the end as we sort of wrestle with our view of who God is and what God's like, which I think is part of what comes out of this story. So let's jump into the text itself. The context for it is the story of Abraham. And in chapter 12 of Genesis, Abraham, as he's called then, is promised by God that he will be given a land, given a whole nation of people to populate that land, and that he will be prosperous. Just before that, though, in chapter 11, right at the end, we hear about Abraham's family and his wife Sarai, and we're told that she's barren, she's infertile, which seems like a throwaway comment at the time. But by the time we get to chapter 12, that creates a sense of intrigue, because how on earth is Abraham, or Abram as he's called then, going to become this great nation when his wife, his family line seems to have come to an end already? That kind of sets the scene for many of the stories that follow. There's this sense of intrigue with sort of two question marks hanging over all the characters. One is around fertility. Many of the matriarchs are infertile. So it begs the question, are they going to be discarded? How is this nation going to develop? How's this family going to move forward? And then over the children, there's a question mark over who's going to inherit the future. Is it the older sibling, as is usually the case in that culture, or is it the younger one, which is very often the case in these stories? And those two aspects are very much present in this story of Jacob and Esau, which we're going to look at now. So let's jump into the text in chapter 25. And we'll begin reading from verse 19. It says this: "This is the account of the family line of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Padan Aram, and sister of Laban the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, 'Why is this happening to me?' So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, 'Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger.' When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out, and grasping the heel of Esau. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. So what we have here is, I think, we kick off the story with two great comparisons. The first one is a comparison between Rebekah and Isaac. We're told that this is the story of Abraham's son Isaac, whereas really, Isaac figures as a very low-key character in this story. It's really about Rebekah and her sons, Jacob and Esau. Whereas Isaac is somewhat of a passive character, Rebekah is a very strong character. She's even given her own genealogy. I don't know if you noticed that. That's very unusual for the ancestry of a woman to be cited in ancient literature, but it is here as a sort of a mark of the strength of who Rebekah is as a protagonist in this story. And she's, like a lot of the matriarchs, she's barren. She's unable to have children, but she eventually conceives and has twins. And These are Jacob and Esau, or Esau and Jacob. Esau is kind of set up from the very beginning here. He's his name means hairy. He's covered in hair. Hairiness in the ancient world was akin to wildness, to unsophistication, if you like. Think of the Epic of Gilgamesh and Gilgamesh's friend Enkidu, who's this sort of subhuman wild character who's covered in hair. Esau seems akin to that, and he's red, and the Hebrew word for red is the Hebrew word, very similar to the Hebrew word for Edom, the nation. We find out later in scripture that Esau is the father of the nation Edom. In fact, the capital of Edom, Seir, is the same root word in Hebrew as the word Esau. So there's a lot of Hebrew punning here to show us that poor old Esau is unlikely to be the successful one. He's unlikely to be the one to carry the promise forward. On the other hand, with Jacob, we're not told what Jacob looks like. We're told how he acts. Even as a baby, he's grasping. He grasps the heel of Esau. The word Jacob is a pun on the word in Hebrew for heel, it means deceiver, grasper, trickster. And so we get a sense that probably it's going to be Jacob's who's going to be the one who wins the day here. And of course, we've seen this before in stories like Cain and Abel, Isaac and Ishmael, where the younger brother prevails over the older. So we're set up in this story for some of the conflict that is to come. Now, Jacob, as they grow up, deceives Esau twice. We're going to look at the first occasion. It follows right on from what we've just read in Genesis chapter 25 and verse 27. It says, "The boys grew up and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, 'Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished.' This is why he is called Edom." That's the word red again. "Jacob replied, 'First sell me your birthright.' 'Look, I'm about to die,' Esau said. 'What good is the birthright to me?' But Jacob said, 'Swear to me first.' So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left." So Esau despised his birthright. Again, we have some interesting comparisons here. Isaac loves Esau, we're told, because he likes the game that he catches. I mean, it doesn't seem like a particularly good reason, but we're given a reason. Whereas Rebekah loves Jacob for no apparent reason, or we're not told. The narrator is silent on that. Perhaps she's trying to counter the favoritism of Isaac, or perhaps she's kind of backing the right horse. She, from that prophecy we heard in the previous passage, knows that Jacob's going to prevail, so she's on Jacob's side. We don't know, but certainly we'll find out that Rebekah herself is a bit of a wheeler and dealer. She's a bit of a trickster herself, and that might be a familial trait that she passes on to Jacob. Her brother Laban, who we'll meet later, is also a bit of a trickster. But in the case of Esau and Jacob, again, we have another interesting comparison. Esau's this outdoors kind of guy, somewhat of a wild guy, and then he comes in famished. And you wonder, why are you famished when you're a hunter? You would think you should have caught some food for yourself. And he's prepared to sell his birthright for a pot of stew in that particular moment. I'm not sure we should take that literally. I mean, who would do that? The birthright is the double inheritance. So the older child would receive double the inheritance of the other children. It's of huge economic value. It seems unusual that someone would just trade that off for a meal. But I think what we're being told here is Esau is someone who lives by his appetites. He kind of lives in the now. He's not thinking ahead. He's not planning ahead. He's just kind of spontaneous and rash. Whereas Jacob is thinking and planning and somewhat manipulative. He's described as a man who stays at home. That word is perhaps translated quiet, or and quiet in the sense of cunning, calculating. It's a difficult word to translate, but certainly that's what comes across in this scene. Jacob uses very sophisticated language, very technical legal language in wrestling the birthright from Esau, whereas Esau uses very coarse language that's not very sophisticated. And immediately following this passage, in the beginning of chapter 26, we read that there's a famine in the land. And I think that really creates, again, a sense of tension. Who do we want to lead Israel into the future? Who do we want to lead this fledgling nation into the future at a time of crisis like a famine? Is it someone like Esau, who lives by his appetites, doesn't think ahead, doesn't plan ahead, or someone like Jacob, who, although he might be somewhat devious, is he's thinking ahead, prepared to manipulate his way into the future, and he might be actually a better person in the political sense to lead on. So the cards are already stacked against Esau, and Jacob has already tricked him out of his birthright. He then tricks him a second time, indirectly, by tricking their father Isaac to give him the firstborn's blessing. This was not an economic thing. This was just a spiritual blessing that the father would give to the firstborn child. But it was taken very, very seriously. And Isaac tells Esau that he wants to give him his blessing. He's getting old. His eyesight is failing. So he sends him off to hunt, to find some game. He says, bring me back something to eat and then I'll give you my blessing. Rebecca, who herself, as we know, is a bit of a trickster, she hears this, overhears it, and brings in Jacob and says, right, take this food in, put these hairy animal skins on your arms, pretend to be Esau, and you'll get the blessing. So Jacob does this, and it's, I think, a tragic story, because Isaac, who's a tragic character, asks multiple times, is that really you? You kind of sound like Jacob to me, even though you feel like Esau and smell like Esau. And they repetitively lie to him, and it's just heartbreaking. But eventually Isaac gives the blessing to Jacob, and Jacob departs. And then Esau returns, and Isaac is heartbroken. He realizes what he's done. And Esau says, well, give me the blessing now. And he says, I can't. I just blessed your brother. I gave him prosperity. I said he would rule over you. And Jacob, Esau is absolutely furious, and he's livid. He wants to kill Jacob. And so the tension is created, and they fall out, and Rebecca kind of intervenes by saying to Jacob, you better get out of town because Esau's going to kill you. And so she tells him to head out to her brother Laban, who lives in Paddan Aram, which is in northwestern Mesopotamia. And she says, go under the guise that you're looking for a wife there. So off goes Jacob. So Jacob now sets off on this quest, on this kind of hero's journey, if you like, where he goes out, he has all kinds of struggles and obstacles to overcome, and somewhat of an adventure, and is transformed by that, and then returns home, and as we'll see in a moment, eventually reconciles with Esau. But he has two experiences, two interesting experiences, one on the way out and one on the way back. I'm going to, again, just sort of skim over these, just to share the story a little bit. But on the way out, he has this dream. He stops, lays his head on a pillow, falls asleep, and dreams that there's a ladder connecting heaven and earth, and there's these angels going up and down. It's called the Dream of Jacob's Ladder. Very famous, been depicted in art in all kinds of varied and beautiful ways. He takes the stone and makes it an altar, which he dedicates to God. And he's kind of somewhat surprised to say that God is here. He calls the place, names the place Bethel, because that's that means house of God. And this, I think, signifies the fact that Jacob realizes that God is present everywhere. The stone, perhaps, represents the fact that God is present in all of creation, not just in certain places at certain times, not just pro certain nations and against others, not just a territorial kind of God, but a universal, omnipresent God. And that's a very different notion of God that's expressed here. I think it's interesting to then hear Jacob's interaction with God, because God says to Jacob, okay, I'm going to be with you, I'll bless you, I'll help you on this journey, remain loyal to me. And Jacob says, okay, well, you know, if God sticks with me, if God makes my way, then I'll be faithful. So he's still wheeling and dealing. There's still conditions. He's it seems, forever the trickster. Anyway, he arrives at his uncle Laban's. He actually meets a young woman at a well, and is typical, as is typical of Hebrew men, it seems in the stories that are told, wells are where you meet your wife. So he falls in love with Rachel, who is Laban's younger daughter. And Laban says, you can marry her if you work for me for 7 years. And so he does that. He works for 7 years. But then Laban tricks Jacob. And he, rather than giving him Rachel, he gives him Leah, his older daughter. Jacob's very upset, but Laban says, well, if you work for me for another 7 years, you can have Rachel. And so he does that, and he eventually marries Rachel. Women treated like a commodity here. Again, very patriarchal society. Rachel is barren. She's infertile. She's obviously Jacob's favorite wife, but she's infertile. And Rebecca was, and Sarah before her. So she gives her gives to Jacob her handmaid, and it's like a scene out of The Handmaid's Tale. He has children through her handmaid. He also has children with Leah, and children through Leah's handmaid. Rachel becomes pregnant herself and gives birth to Joseph. And there's an interesting little bit of interaction, though, I think, also between Rachel and Leah. They're kind of at odds with each other. There's a lot of jealousy. They kind of barter with one another over who would have sex with Jacob. And Jacob is, so he's almost like a passive character in this. He doesn't come across in that sense as a strong male character. The women seem to be much stronger. In one episode, they barter with mandrake roots, and Rachel seems to want mandrake roots. Mandrake roots, if you remember from sort of folkloric history, including in the movie Harry Potter or in the books Harry Potter, the mandrakes figure prominently there. They have these magical qualities, medicinal qualities, and including a cure for or helping with infertility. And so Rachel may have sought out these mandrakes in order to get pregnant. But it's interesting, just in that episode, I think there is, again, some women have some control in this story. They're not just passive characters, which is a little unusual in the ancient world. But Jacob carries on with Laban. He works for him, and he then deceives Laban. He tricks Laban, and he does it in this kind of sneaky way by taking some of his own herds of goats and sheep and breeding them with the stronger ones of Laban's herd. And as a result, he builds up a very strong herd, and Laban's gets weaker and weaker. So Jacob becomes much more wealthy. And Laban catches on to this, and they have a falling out themselves. And he's kind of chased out of town. Eventually they reconcile somewhat, and Jacob decides it's time to go home. And he heads off back to his homeland, but he knows he has to face Isaac. And he seems to be predisposed to reconciling with Isaac. There's a little bit of ambiguity here. Like, is he seeking to reconcile with Esau? Sorry, not Isaac, Esau, I should have said earlier. Is he seeking to reconcile with Esau, mercenary kind of way? He just, he needs to get back home. And so he's going to sort of pay off Esau and hope everything will be okay. Or is he truly remorseful? We're not 100% sure yet. What he does do is send some messengers ahead, and they bear all kinds of gifts of animals and all kinds of expensive items for Esau. That's obviously intended to please Esau. The messengers return and say to Jacob, yeah, we gave the gifts to Esau, and he's coming to meet you with 400 men. So Jacob is understandably nervous about that. He's not quite sure what kind of response this is. Maybe Esau's out to get him. Maybe Esau still bears a grudge. He keeps moving forward on his journey, and he sends his family across the Jabbok River. And this is a very significant river for Jacob. It's actually a pun on his name, Jacob, the Jabbok River. And he stays behind for the night, and he's prevented from crossing when he decides to by this strange figure. It's described as a man, but this man fights with Jacob and wrestles with him and refuses to let him cross the river. And we're going to pick up that story here as Jacob is returning in Genesis chapter 32. Here's what it says. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." So this is a really interesting story, because Jacob wrestles with someone who he later seems to think was God. But in the text, it says it was the man. So we're not really sure. It's a very unusual kind of encounter. I think what's important here, though, is that this is a transforming moment in Jacob's life. This is an important part of the hero's return. He's different. Not only is he physically different, he limps because of this injury he receives. There's a sort of vulnerability to him now, if you like. But his name is changed, and his name is changed to Israel, meaning one who wrestles with God, or one who struggles with God. And I think what we're getting here is that Jacob is sort of the exemplar, if you like, of a person connected to God in the Hebrew sense. And that is somebody who wrestles with God, not somebody who just submits or who seeks to placate God, but someone who engages with God, someone who is not just a pushover. And, you know, it's interesting to compare Jacob with characters that have gone before him. For instance, Adam and Eve were portrayed as ones who kind of rebelled against God, who free will didn't work, if you like. Noah is portrayed as one who's on the opposite end of the spectrum, just blind obedience. He doesn't, when he's told to build an ark and God tells him he's going to destroy the earth, God, Noah just receives it blindly and obediently. Abraham's a bit of a mixture. He kind of barters with God over Sodom and Gomorrah, but at the same time is blindly obedient in offering to and being willing to sacrifice his own son Isaac when God apparently tells him to do so. So it seems like there's this sort of back and forth that we see in the characters that God relates to in the Hebrew story. And in Jacob, it's like God is saying, "This is what I want. I want someone who's going to engage with me, someone who's going to wrestle with me, someone who will contend with me." That's the sort of relationship that I'm looking for. That's kind of different, I think, to the relationship we might expect this kind of a God to want to have with people. But that's what we're seeing here in the text. So Jacob crosses over the river. We'll come back to that point in a minute, because I think it's relevant for us in how we apply this story. But Jacob crosses the river, and he approaches Esau. He's very nervous, and there's a lot of tension at this point. But what we read in Genesis 33 is, I think, really beautiful. In verse 4, it says this: "But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept." And that, I think, is not only a beautiful reconciliation, which kind of cuts the tension, it just breaks the tension. But it's also, I think, very reminiscent for us of another story that we read in the Christian scriptures, a story that actually Jesus told in Luke 15. And if we look at that story, which was about a son and a father that fell out, and the son goes off and then decides to return and hopes that his father will accept him again. In chapter 15 of Luke, in verse 20, we read, "So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him, and he was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him." Just beautiful language, and it's hard to imagine that the writer of Luke was not thinking about the story of Jacob and Esau when they wrote those words down. So a beautiful reconciliation between Jacob and Esau. We hear a bit more about that in the subsequent verses in chapter 38, verse 8 to 11. It says, "Esau asked, 'What's the meaning of all these flocks and herds I met?'" In other words, these gifts that Jacob has sent on ahead of him to try and placate Esau. "To find favor in your eyes, my lord," he said. But Esau said, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. No, please, said Jacob. If I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me, for to see your face is like seeing the face of God. Now that you have received me favorably, please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need. And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. I think what we see here is how these two brothers are no longer worrying about money, about economics, about possessions, about birthrights and blessings and that kind of thing. They're just seeing each other's humanity and seeing themselves as brothers rather than as commodities or people to be used and abused. And there's something just beautiful and touching about that. And that seems at the heart of reconciliation, to see the face of God in another. How could we not reconcile if we saw one another that way? How could we not feel accepted if others saw us that way? Just really beautiful language. So let's talk a little bit then about how we might apply this to our own lives. What source of comfort and hope can we take from this story for our time? And I want to look at this in both from the personal perspective. I mean, you know, many of us are in situations where we need to forgive or be forgiven. We're seeking reconciliation that way. I think we need reconciliation in our society collectively. And also, I think there's probably a sense in which we need reconciliation with God. And what I mean by that is perhaps we're out of sorts with God. We might be angry at God or confused by God, especially in a time like this. And how can we reconcile that? How can we come to terms with God, if you like, and perhaps wrestle a bit with God? So we'll look at all these things. First of all, I'm going to make 5 points here. Reconciliation is a journey. It's a process. We see this reconciliation played out over several chapters. It's a long story. It doesn't just happen instantly. It's kind of backwards and forwards and at times confusing and complicated. And most of us probably find ourselves in the middle of this kind of a story. Some of us may have experienced beautiful reconciliation, and that's wonderful. And I think that itself is very comforting. But maybe we need to seek comfort in the fact that even though we're in situations that haven't really resolved yet, we're not alone. And we're on this journey, we're in a process, it's not over yet. And I think of a situation actually that I'm in at the moment. Some time ago, I fell out with a person who's very, very dear to me. And I won't go into all the details of this story because it's not just my story to tell, it affects other people. But this particular person was not necessarily behaving in the best way possible. But I reacted really badly to them on this one particular occasion. It was at a moment of vulnerability for me. I was feeling insecure and vulnerable myself, but I reacted really badly. And I quickly apologized and asked for forgiveness, but I know I really hurt that other person. And they chose not to forgive me. And that was heartbreaking and has been heartbreaking. And there's honestly not a day that goes by where I don't think about it. I don't feel the pain of it. I don't feel intense remorse about how I responded. And I just long for reconciliation. But I don't have control over that. That's not something I can make happen. So many of you might be able to identify with that, where we're in a situation where we want reconciliation, but it's not being offered to us. Or maybe we're waking up to the fact that we might have hurt other people and we need to reconcile. Perhaps waking up to the fact that we need forgiveness. So we can take comfort, I think, in knowing that it doesn't all happen instantly. This is a journey. And as long as we're moving forward on the journey, there's a much greater chance, a much greater hope that there will be a good resolution. And we can take control of the things that are on our side of the equation. So we, for instance, can forgive somebody even if they're not prepared to forgive us. And that leads on to this second point, which is treat people how you want to be treated. In other words, forgive people, especially when you want to be forgiven. This is obviously at the heart of Jesus's teaching in Matthew chapter 7, which is part of the Sermon on the Mount that we looked at recently. in verse 12, it says, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets." In other words, don't treat people how they deserve to be treated. If somebody isn't forgiving you, don't treat them that way, but rather treat them how you would want to be treated. And that really flips all of this sense of reconciliation on its head in a beautiful, beautiful way, or this sense of justice, shall I say, on its head in a beautiful way. I think what we see in this story actually is kind of the opposite played out in some respects. One of the morals of this story of Jacob and Esau, it could be trick and you will be tricked, because there's this sort of sense of karma here in that Jacob, who tricks his brother, his older brother, out of the birthright, is then tricked by his mother's brother. You know, he's obviously helped by his mother, and then his mother's brother tricks him with his older daughter rather than his younger daughter. There's a sort of a tit for tat here, and so Jacob kind of receives what he's already given. The more biblical view of that would probably be you reap what you sow, or if you live by the sword, you die by the sword, or in more colloquial terms, what goes around comes around. And that might not sound actually very hopeful or comforting to us, because we're like, oh, do I really want to I really want to reap what I sowed? But I think it can provoke us to the golden rule of Jesus. Do to others as you'd have them do to you. But also, even when some of the injustice we perpetrate comes back on us, it's actually an opportunity for us to change. And this leads on to the third point, which is not just treat people how you want to be treated, but suffering can be an opportunity to grow in empathy. In other words, we are given an opportunity when suffering comes to us, perhaps even sort of this sense of what goes around coming around. It creates an opportunity for us to change and not be the same going into the future. I think we see that in Jacob's life, that he, as a result of him suffering at the hands of Laban, and in other situations too, he ceases to be this wheeler and dealer and becomes much more vulnerable, much more sensitive, much more empathetic, and seeks out reconciliation. I think this is a really important point for us, and again, a source of hope and comfort, because I think it affects us perhaps collectively. Like, I think collectively we struggle to be empathetic. So privileged populations, I think, struggle to really empathize with oppressed populations, and we can sort of hide away in our bubble of privilege and comfort, and not really see truly what's going on in the lives of other people who are oppressed. And this leads on to the fourth point, which, and I'll come back to this empathy issue in a second, but the fourth point is to love another person is to see the face of God. This is obviously a quote from Victor Hugo in his novel Les Miserables, and it's a line actually in the musical. And it's taken from this story of Jacob and Esau. Jacob says to Esau, you know, when I see you, I see the face of God. So this speaks to our common humanity, and that we all bear the divine image. It speaks to, I think, to the struggle that we have collectively to see that. We don't always see ourselves as one with other people. We struggle to empathize. We struggle to see the face of God in people who are either our enemies or very different to us, or in a very different situation to us. And I think this is where the empathy comes in. Let me explain perhaps about our current situation. I think right now we are seeing more than ever, perhaps, or we have an opportunity more than ever to see our common humanity in the pandemic crisis that we're in. And we're seeing the inequality of it. We're seeing the fact that the effects of this pandemic are affecting the poor. They're affecting people along issues, racial lines, much more severely than many other cultures. It's tragic, it's terrible, it's awful. We see the inequality and we're angry about it, and we're traumatized by it. But the reality is that inequality has always been there, especially when we think about health. It's always the poor, and very often poverty determined by race because of history and systems that mean that poor people are often more unhealthy and are subject to diseases more than people who are in a more privileged position. So this inequality has always been with us. And yet we're more angry about it now, and we're seeing it for what it is, and we're celebrating things like the stimulus package and action that's been taken to help people who really need it. But the big question is, why have we not been so angry before? Why have we not been so traumatized before? And I think some of this has to do with the fact that this particular situation we're in has crossed boundaries. The coronavirus, this particular coronavirus, has come right to our doorstep. It's crossed a boundary that it hasn't before. And so we are vulnerable. Privileged people feel vulnerable. People in communities that have heretofore not felt this sense of insecurity are now feeling insecure. We might get the virus. We might be sick. We might have loss of income. We might lose loved ones. And we're suffering with what many other people have always suffered with. But we just haven't really noticed. And I think the key to this is the previous point. It's suffering causes empathy. That's kind of a hard point to take, and it might not feel all that comforting in some respects. But I think in another way, it's very hopeful and very comforting, because if this pandemic was not a pandemic, but an epidemic and just contained in Africa, let's say, I don't think, or I wonder, would we be seeing the same kind of response, the same kind of traumatized response, the same kind of anger and the same kind of aggressive action against it that we are seeing today. The fact that it's crossed boundaries, the fact that it's become much closer to us, means that we are empathizing way more because of our suffering and taking action accordingly. And what we have to do, I think, as we go forward is as a human race collectively, is embrace reconciliation by not going back. When this eventually resolves, it will be very easy for us to go back to our old ways of inequality. But we have an opportunity right now, because of our empathy and this empathetic state that we're in, to be different. And that's part of reconciliation, I think. And that's really hopeful. And that can be really comforting for us collectively, even though it probably feels quite uncomfortable for many of us who have been on the beneficiary side of that equation up until now. Finally, the last point is, it's okay to wrestle with God. And on this one, I really want to just address the fact that I think many of us are struggling with our spirituality right now in this current crisis. Is God in control? Is God loving? Is God the kind of being that gives coronavirus or takes coronavirus away? How should we pray? Is it worth praying? Are we just being left alone? Does God intervene? Does God care? All those questions, I think, are very normal, typical questions that come up right now. And you know, very, very often there are answers to those questions that satisfy some people, but some of those answers don't satisfy others. And I think it causes us to struggle. And we can be uncomfortable with that struggle. It doesn't necessarily feel like hopeful or comfortable or comforting. But I think this story tells us that it's okay to struggle. It's okay, in fact, to wrestle with God, to be active in our wrestling, to question, to doubt, to struggle with. And rather than just accepting perhaps our previous or up to now perceptions about what God is like or who God is, situations arise that cause us to ask questions and to struggle with that. And let's do that. Let's struggle with it. Let's not just quietly acquiesce. I don't think this story is telling us to do that. Let's not just submit and pretend that there's nothing wrong or that we don't have any issues. I think that leads to anger, frustration, resentment, and not reconciliation. I'm not saying that there's an easy answer to this. I think we've all got to do that struggling and wrestling ourselves. But let's do that rather than just backing away or ignoring it. Part of this story of reconciliation is coming to terms with God. That doesn't just mean submitting to God as some authority figure who cannot be questioned, but someone with whom we can wrestle. And that's going to change our views of God. And I think we've got to be prepared for that, even though that can feel a little bit scary. and uncomfortable in and of itself. Let's do that. Let's engage. I think we can. What can help us with that is some of the issues that are in the materials for this week, as we explore the emotional side of this and use poetry and music and art to help us with that, and then have conversations with one another. There's some at the end of the material. There's some discussion questions about how you experienced the artistic expressions and how you experienced this message, for instance, how you experienced the story of Jacob Musil when you read it. And let's share honestly with one another in our groups about how we're doing that wrestling. Let's share, if we're not in a group, let's find a trusted friend and share with them. And together continue this journey of reconciliation that's about our personal relationships, about our collective humanity, and coming to terms with who God is. Thanks so much for listening. Please again do download the discussion materials, and I hope that you take great comfort and have great hope through reading the story of Jacob and Esau. Thanks so much.